Hello, everyone. This is Betsy Wurzel, your host of Chatting with Betsy on Patrick Roll Talk Radio Network, a subsidiary of Global Media Network, LLC. Our mantra is to educate, enlighten, and entertain. And do I have a special guest today? I just love Dr. Ronald Dwinelles. If I could, I would clone him. He's so talented, so compassionate. Dr. Ronald Dwinelles was on my show before, back in September, and the show was posted October 10th. So if you don't already subscribe to Chatting with Betsy, I suggest you do so, so you can hear my wonderful guests like Dr. Ronald Dwinelles. And in the first interview, he talked about his award-winning book, 30 Days Had September. Dr. Ronald Dwinelles also wrote an award-winning book, Don't Pick Up All the Dog Hairs. Dr. Ron is founder and president of the Butterflies and Holt Memorial Foundation, whose mission is to support and improve the lives of children, adolescents, and young people suffering from behavioral and mental health issues. He is also did medical research and CEO of One Health in Ohio. I want to welcome you, Dr. Ronald Dwinelles, to Chatting with Betsy again.
Thanks, Betsy. Yeah, it's good to see you, or no, I don't see you, but I can see you through my mind. But it's good to be here again with you. So thanks. Thanks for inviting me.
You are welcome. And I just want to say before I forget, Dr. Ronald Dwinelles is writing another book. He's going to come on and talk about it when it's published, called Climbing Jacob's Ladder, which sounds phenomenal. And I have to say to the audience, Dr. Ronald Dwinelles, you are one of the most compassionate people. And I'm sure you and all that you do, I know you're a great pediatrician. If I didn't already mention that, folks, Dr. Ronald Dwinelles is a pediatrician. And he has such a heart for people. That's why you created the foundation. What inspired you to create Butterflies and Holt Memorial Foundation?
Well, it was multiple things, Betsy. First of all, my background as a pediatrician, I saw a lot of kids that had a lot of behavioral health problems and issues and so forth. In fact, a lot of the physical diagnosis types of things that I made were basically based on their mental social conditions. In other words, they lived in bad environments or, by the way, my practice was always in an inner city setting. So a lot of these kids came from broken homes and so forth, and a lot of times their social and behavioral complexities and issues brings on some of the physical symptoms. It's kind of one of those mind over matter types of things. But I saw it a lot, so that was my initial foray, if you will, into the behavioral health world of kids. And then over time, I realized that my parents lived kind of dysfunctional lives, and it created some issues for them and so forth. And then I realized that there's a lot of people like that. A lot of people had dysfunctional or very difficult lives and so forth, which sometimes created behavioral mental health issues. So, you know, and I wanted to do something about it. So after my mom passed away, my mom had had Alzheimer's, and after she passed away, she left us three boys a little bit of money, and I took my share and started this foundation to honor my parents. So that's how I began the foundation, and basically the foundation, it's really difficult to directly affect the kids. So early on, I focused in on creating awareness, because a lot of people are not aware of kids having behavioral health issues and why they have them. So there's a whole science in pediatric medicine called ACEs. ACEs stands for Adverse Childhood Experiences. And what that basically means is that, in a nutshell, what it implies is that kids who grow up in adverse conditions tend to grow up to become our future depressed people, our future addiction people, our future suicide people, and so forth. They don't do well in society. They don't have good jobs. They don't relate well to social conformity and those kinds of things. So I'm rambling now, Betsy, but
you're not rambling at all. What does ACEs stand for? I was writing it down. Adverse Childhood Experiences.
Experiences. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And what does the S stand for at the end?
That's it. ACE and ACEs, you know, so it's just the plural of ACE.
Okay. Gotcha.
Yeah. I think some people use symptoms or something like that, but it's adverse childhood experiences is the main thing.
Oh, no, you're not rambling at all. You're giving out excellent information. And your foundation is a nonprofit. Is that correct?
Yes, yes. Yeah, it's a family foundation that I just started, from my mom's funds. But, so what we do locally here is that I use the funds to support basically educational and awareness for like our first responders, the police, the fire people, the teachers, social workers, and those types of people, where we have classes. We hire people who are experts at this, and they conduct classes that makes people aware of, you know, of what are the signs and symptoms of these kids that have ACEs or that are suffering from ACEs, and what can we do about it? Well, basically, there's no medicines or anything to treat these kids. It's essentially creating resilience, and you create resilience through counseling or through people who end up taking these kids under their wings and so forth. I don't even know if this organization exists, but remember the Big Brothers of America?
Yes.
I don't know. Is that still around? Because I haven't heard anything.
I don't know, but I remember hearing that all the time.
Yeah, but that's kind of an early attempt of creating these types of environments for these kids. You know, the kids grow up in an adverse household. And what I mean by that is these kids are the ones that get physically abused, emotionally abused, sexually abused. These kids are the ones that witness their moms getting beat up. There's violence in the house. Somebody goes to jail in the house. You know, the really bad things. And you know, a lot of us are sheltered from that, but those are real things that happen quite frequently. And again, just imagine, can these kids grow up normally? And typically they don't. And what's interesting is there is actually a physical way of determining that these kids are suffering from ACEs, and that's basically MRIs of the brain. So we can actually do an MRI imaging of these kids' brains and show that these neural pathways are not well developed. If we wanted to make a physical diagnosis, we could do testings like that. But basically it's a diagnosis of sociological means, you know, finding out the social history and those kinds of things. Yeah.
Wow. I just want the audience just to take a pause here
Yeah.
Because this is what I'm talking about, your character, Dr. Ron. You received money, and unfortunately your mom died, and you took that money to help people. That is the most beautiful way, in my opinion, to honor your parents' memory. I always say this. You know, the best way to honor our loved ones is to help others, and you're doing that. That is so beautiful. If you were in front of me, I would hug you.
Oh,
I would.
Well, thank you.
You're welcome.
I would check on that. Yeah.
Yeah, that is just speaks beautiful of the person that you are. So I'm hoping not embarrassing you, but I just have to say that because you're painting a picture of your compassion and your love to help people. You didn't have to do this. You could have taken that money and went on vacation. You could have bought maybe another house. But you used it to help your environment. That's awesome.
Thanks for that recognition. But you know, I did not want to squander away my mom's money. They weren't wealthy. My parents weren't wealthy, and they worked hard and they saved money and so forth. And I didn't want to just take that money and just spend it, and then in a year it's gone. You know, I wanted to use it to have meaning. And part of it is I recognize my mom's life. So just briefly about my mom's life. My mom was Japanese, and she had five sisters and one brother. And her father owned a large dairy farm in the southern island of Japan, and a very successful man and so forth. The mother died when she was two. So, but the father was always busy at the dairy farm, so he was rarely there. They were wealthy enough where they had housekeepers and cooks and maids and so forth. So he was very successful. But that's how she was raised, by these housekeepers and so forth, and by her older siblings. So it was dysfunctional, and every periodically the father would come home, but my mom would always say he was drunk. And I don't know if he was drunk because, you know, he was just so stressed out from work and, you know, having to take care of these kids. She never knew that, but it was scary to her. And you know, and basically the family was dysfunctional. They didn't have order. They didn't have routines. It sounded like it was kind of a free for all. So she did not grow up in the best of environments. And that's a form of ACEs too. That's an adverse childhood experience. So she grew up, and you know, and then the war came, and she witnessed a lot of death. In fact, back in the later 40s, the U.S. had a firebombing campaign. So they would go around these large cities, and then they would drop napalm, basically, which ignited a lot of the homes and so forth. And a lot of the homes back then were built of wood and not concrete and so forth. So anyway, a lot of fires, and she would often tell me stories about how she's running through the streets. It's really hot, but she's stepping on bodies to get to the river. One time she was running towards the river, which everybody did to cool off from the heat. And napalm was dropped on the river, which ignited the river, you know, and a lot of people were killed that way as well. So she saw, you know, death and destruction and violence, and she saw all that. So again, that's another example of ACEs. So through the years, and, you know, when I was born and she became a unwed mother. So my dad was a U.S. military man, and, you know, she was, in the eyes of the Japanese, she was consorting with the enemy because she had a American boyfriend, and you know, she gets pregnant,
yeah,
and she has me.
That didn't go well.
And that didn't go well. No, no.
That didn't go over well.
And Japan is it's a pretty homogeneous society. You know, they don't have a lot of different races there. So and then especially the enemy, because Americans were the enemies, right? So she you know, some of it is kind of interesting, but she consorts with the enemy. She has a baby. That's me. My dad goes away because he's in the military. He gets stationed in Korea and goes a couple other places. So she became a single mom, and they weren't married. And because of that, it was taboo in the Japanese society. And you know, her family disowned her. So again, another form of ACEs and so forth. But what's interesting, what I recognized later was I think I became her resilience, because she suddenly had a child to take care of. She had a responsibility, and I think that kind of helped her. I'd like to think that it helped, like I helped my mom, but I think that kind of helped her overcome some of those adversities as a child, because she suddenly had a responsibility, another human life that she had to take care of. And I was her world, and obviously she was my world, because that's the only person I knew. I didn't have a dad at that time. So I think that's another reason why I really wanted to do this, because I know my mom went through that. My dad did come back, just to finish the story. My dad did come back when I was almost six, and they ended up getting married. So you know, it was a happy ending. I had adverse childhood experiences because, yeah, I did grow up in a single parent household. But because I was half American, I used to get into fights with the Japanese kids because, you know how that goes. So I was always fighting other kids. But what's funny is, so when they got married and I came to the States, I suddenly got into fights with American kids because now I'm a Jap, you know, I'm the enemy on this side too. So I was kind of like, you know, a guy without a home, I guess, for a while. So, you know, and those are adversities, but for me, I did have my mom as my resilience. And I remember the first time I got in a fight in Japan. I run home and I tell my mom, and my mom says, "Well, go back and hit them." So I don't know if that was the best advice. It's probably not socially acceptable these days, but anyway, so those are all examples of ACEs and resilience and so forth. And that's why it became a passion of mine, is I didn't want to squander away my mom's money that she earned, you know, and you know, through a lot of hard work, and I wanted to do something good. So I'm happy that I did it. And what's another interesting thing is that, so there was only so much money, so the money runs out eventually. So I ended up doing fundraisers, and I did fundraising by climbing mountains. That's a hobby of mine. I climbed big mountains like Kilimanjaro and Fuji and some European mountains, all the Western mountains in the U.S. But I would climb mountains as a fundraising event locally. So people could follow me when I climbed the mountains. And if I got to the top, people would donate X number of dollars. And, you know, it got a little complicated, but it worked. And people locally were very supportive of those ventures and so forth.
That is incredible. That's an incredible story. And then I know that your dad suffered from mental health issues. Maybe it was post-traumatic from being in the war, I'm sure.
I think,
you know,
it could be he grew
a huge
up
problem.
In, mm-hmm. he grew up during the Depression too, and you know, and I know he had a hard time then, and then he joined the Army when he was he always says or said he was 17, but anyway, he joined the military early so that he could get, as he said, so he could have food to eat. And he saw the war, lots of stuff in the war, and yes, and he later he died of suicide, and that was a major part of my effort through Butterflies and Hope, that you know, can we prevent that by identifying these ACEs kids early and trying to do some interventions early? And you know, and my mantra is always, if you can help one person, then it was all worth it. So so
absolutely.
Yeah, so I guess a lot of it is, yeah, I think a lot of my motivation and inspiration was empathy for my parents, my experiences and so forth. So, you know, maybe the so-called giving back type of thing.
Yes, well, you definitely have. I'm a huge, huge mental health advocate, Dr. Ron, and sorry about your dad. And it's so unfortunate, I say this a lot on my show, that, and there's a lot of vets now, even in today's day and age, who are dying by suicide. And I feel that very strongly about this. We have to change the way we raise our boys. It should be acceptable for a boy to cry, to show emotion in a constructive atmosphere. And the worst thing, and I've heard it say to my son when my husband died, his father died, is to be strong. People, I'm a Jersey girl. I'm going to say it the way it is. Stop telling people that.
Yeah.
Stop telling people to be strong, because you know what? They are strong. They have been strong. We can't be strong all the time. And it's okay for a man to cry. It's okay for a man to show emotion. And I think if it was more acceptable for men to go for support, they wouldn't be dying by suicide. But because it's that stigma, I think it's a little less now, but there's still the stigma that, I can't go for help. That's a weakness. It's not a weakness, folks. It's a strength. Whether you're a man or a woman, non-binary, whatever you are, if to say, you know what, I need help. I need support. And it's okay to get that support. I have to ask you this, Dr. Ron. How long have you been a pediatrician?
I have been a pediatrician for about 40 years now.
Wow.
Yeah, because I graduated from medical school in 1983, and I finished my residency in 1986. So I guess next year it'll be 40 years. Yeah.
Wow.
So I've been a doctor.
Wonderful.
Yeah. So I've been a doctor for what, 42 years? Yeah. This is my 42nd year. It doesn't feel like it.
No, time goes by fast. Well, God bless you for all that you do. So you've seen so many changes in the 40 something years.
Mm-hmm.
Do you, and obviously, you've seen a change with children's behaviors. Why are children struggling so much now more than ever before? I mean, even children from what you would call, lack of a better word, well-to-do homes, both parents are there, and they still have anxiety. They still have depression. Suicide rate is up. With children and teenagers, why do you feel, do you think social media has something to do with it? What's your opinion? I'd like to know your opinion.
Yeah, well, that's a really, really good question, and that would probably be a whole podcast in itself. But yeah, because there's a lot to it. But what's really interesting is what you just said. And I had I was having a discussion somewhat similar this morning with someone about. Hey, kids don't play outside anymore. You ever see kids in the neighborhood play outside? No. You know,
no, not much. No.
No, they don't know how to do things either. They don't know how to fix things. They don't know how to play. They don't know how to imagine. You know, so there's a lot of that. And I believe that a lot of this is because of social media, the computers, and so forth. Everything is imagined for them, right? The televisions, right. The computers, games, all that stuff is already imagined by somebody else, and then you just kind of play it. So I think a lot of those things, I don't know, maybe way back when, maybe they were kind of like buffers for us, you know, to just to enjoy and let go and do things. But we don't have too much of that anymore. The other thing that that's really interesting, in fact, I just read this article this morning about all these kids being on psychotropic drugs.
And that's what I'm talking really, about, yes.
Yeah. So in fact, I have the paper right here. It was an article in the Wall Street Journal, actually. In 1996, the share of American children on psychotropic medication was 3.9%. So that's in 96. In 2002, it was 9.3%.
Wow.
And then, but among children in foster care, it was 35%. I mean, what a huge difference. And then it goes on to say, according to a 2014 study, psychotropic medications are prescribed to 85% of children diagnosed with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, 60% of those with bipolar disorder, and 57% with those with depression. So, but the point is all these kids are getting medicated too. Like, I think way over what they should. I know the psychotropic drugs for attention deficit disorders are way over prescribed. I know it. I see it. And we, in my organization, we have internal rules on what's the process of getting to the point where you have to prescribe the drugs. You know, in other words, they have to go to a psychologist or a counselor to get tested and all these things first. Even some counseling before they're even put on these drugs. But not everybody does that. But it's a major, major problem. So I believe that contributes to, you know, it's kind of like, oh, well, my friends take drugs, and because they're depressed, I'm depressed too. So, you know, so I don't know. I think it's a complicated society these days compared to when we were kids. Yeah.
Oh, definitely. That's true. You know what, Dr. Ron? Like, I suffer from depression as a child.
Yeah.
And you didn't talk about that. You didn't talk about your feeling.
Yeah.
And you know, I grew up in an emotionally abusive home, and I guess you could say I have ACE. My father, you know, would make fun of me and told me I was ugly, and he was just emotionally abusive. And, you know, when you feel depressed, that could lead into, you know, other problems. I broke the barrier in my house. I wanted to go for help. And you're talking 1974, I was 16. That was not talked about. I was gaslighted. I was made fun of. To go for help. And I think that, you know, as parents or guardians, if your children are showing signs of depression, or if they're saying to you, I'm sad, take it seriously. Don't just think it's a phase. and take them for psychological help. Because it's very important. And I realize now, I was depressed because three of my friends moved away all at the same time, within the same time frame. And the way I was treated at home, like I didn't exist. So, but I couldn't, I didn't know that was depression. I just knew I was sad. And of course, my mother would be like, you don't have nothing to be sad about. There's children worse off than you. Of course there were. But that didn't help me deal with my sadness. And I just think that if, parents, guardians need to recognize this. And I know, like, I've done a lot of interviews with different mental health people, and the pressure in society now to look a certain way or to be a certain way, and, of course, social media 24/7, these kids are addicted to it, that causes their anxiety. Oh, they didn't get a like on their Instagram or their Facebook, or someone, you know, made a comment, and the bullying. The bullying could be 24/7 now. So I could see where kids have problems.
Yeah, you can't get
plus
away
their
from
environment.
That.
No.
Yeah, I agree. I agree.
No, you
can't. I want to make a comment on that whole concept about, earlier you talked about boys and men can't show their feelings. So going back to my dad, that was precisely the problem, one of the problems there. So, yeah, he had this past history of, the rough childhood, the war, and those kinds of things. But so he marries my mom. Well, my mom is Japanese, so they have a whole different cultural set, from back then. It's
right.
So men are not supposed to have any feelings. That's the Japanese culture back in the 20s, 30s, 40s, and they are not, they never cry. My mom used to tell me these things when I was a kid, over and over and over. No, boys don't cry, things like that, because it was a cultural thing.
Yeah. American too, Dr. Ron. America too. Yeah.
Yeah. So when my dad started having symptoms of depression as he got older, sometimes he would feel really bad and she would really belittle him. I saw this with my own eyes, well, what's wrong with you? You're not a man, stand up and be stronger, those kinds of things. So he was embarrassed to show his feelings. And my mom had no concept of, you might need a psychiatrist to talk with or somebody, so he kept it in himself, and as a result, the one thing that affected me was about 2 weeks before he committed the suicide, he and I were in the basement of our house, and he was crying, and I said, oh, what's wrong? And he said, well, if I had any guts, I'd kill myself. He was so miserable.
Oh,
and,
my God.
Again, I was programmed, if you will, by my mom that men aren't supposed to do that. And I'm young. I'm a late teenager. And I didn't know what to say. What's a kid say when somebody tells you that? I don't know what to say. So I turned around and I walked away. And, and that's haunted me ever since. It haunts me at this point when I'm even talking about it, because I felt that my dad, obviously, looking back now, he was reaching out for help, and I think he was reaching out to me just to say something, and I walked away, and the guilt never goes away. But again, coming back full circle, what you said is absolutely true. If he had somebody that he could have talked to relieve his stress, depression, whatever, that might have made a big, big difference.
Well, what year was that, Ron? What time period are you talking about?
Yeah, that was back in the early 80s.
Yeah,
Yeah.
it wasn't talked about. You know, it just was
No.
not
No. Yeah. Yeah.
talked about. And it, like, I
Yeah,
know
it had been
I
going
can
on since the 70s.
understand. Yeah, like, I can understand you feeling guilty, although it's not your fault. But
Yeah.
look how you were raised, so you didn't know any
Yeah.
better. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, what would you
Yeah.
just say? Because you were raised by your mom telling you
Right.
don't cry. This is also
Right.
was taught in America. As a
Yeah, I
girl,
know.
like, my father saw crying as being weak,
Yeah.
even as a girl, me being a girl. You know, that's weak if you cry. You're a baby.
Yeah.
Cry
Yeah.
baby. That's what I was called, a cry
Yeah.
baby. Well, I'm still
Yeah.
a cry baby, so you
Well, good for
know,
you,
you can
though.
call me a cry baby. I don't care. I'm proud of it. And boys, if boys cried, yeah, they were pounced upon, and it's just not right. And that's what I try to do with my show, Dr. Ron, is trying to change the world and getting the world to think different, because we all have problems, and sometimes in a point of life, we might need help. And people shouldn't judge someone because they take an antidepressant or anti-anxiety, or they go for help, because you don't know what life has in store for you. Now, my sister, she made fun of me and they called me names because I went for counseling, and later on, she went for counseling. So you really don't know. And you know, there are certain professions like police officers. They have a high suicide rate.
Right.
Servicemen, women, now even doctors, even
Yep.
medical doctors are having a high suicide rate. It's like, what's going on here? And it's frowned upon, I heard, in the medical profession. And it's that old boys network, you know, you're a doctor, toughen up. You know, the
Yep.
people die. But it's just very difficult. And at your father's time, World War II, they didn't treat PTSD. They didn't
No.
talk about that.
No.
I know my father had it. I'm sure my father-in-law had it. My father-in-law was an alcoholic. My uncle used to punch walls. So I don't think anyone can come back normal, whatever that means,
No.
from being in service and seeing what they witnessed. There's just no way to get that out of your head.
Yeah.
You
Yeah.
know,
Yeah.
but what a service you're providing in your community for these children to get help so that they can have a better quality of life. You know, what
Right.
goes on in people's homes is just, it's a shame. It's
Yeah.
a real shame what happens. And
Yeah. Yeah.
yeah, I'm sure, you know, you've seen it all.
Yeah. The problem with my profession, the doctor profession, is that 'cause I've known a lot of doctors, friends of mine that were depressed and suicidal, and some, you know, some went through with it, and it's the stigma. Okay, so if you're a doctor and you're depressed and so forth, and the word gets out, people might not come to you. You know, why would they want to come to you
Yeah.
when you got a problem yourself? And you know, so that's, you know, and that takes away patients from you and so forth. The other is it does create a stigma, and hospitals don't want the potential liability of somebody working in the hospital with depression or whatever, although there is a lot of them around, but so they might not give them hospital privileges. That's happened. Or the state medical board may not give them the license.
I heard
You know, I've
that.
known, oh yeah, I've known,
Yeah.
and but that's kind of, but it's one of those rock and hard place things though, because Okay, so if somebody has a mental illness and they're depressed and the state grants them a license, but they're kind of unstable and they take care of patients and they die because maybe the doctor wasn't, you know, fully alert and you know, it was at the top of his or her game, then it becomes a liability issue. And, you know, the person dies, the patient dies. So it's one of those. You know, it's kind of so yeah, I have seen some of my colleagues have their license revoked or suspended because they had severe depression or whatever. Not all of them got it back. You know, some of them got suspended temporarily, which is better because then they could go for help and so forth, and you know, and then the state would give it back to them. But it's not consistent the way it works. So that's part of the reason I think that there is a higher or fairly high suicide rate amongst doctors is because they don't want to get treatment because of fear of losing their position or losing patients and so forth. So I think that's kind of the dilemma that most of the doctors are in. You know,
wow, that's a shame.
Yeah.
I'll tell you this. This is how I feel. I would rather go to a doctor who's getting treatment than to go to a doctor who's high on drugs or drunk. And I have heard about doctors. I used to work in a hospital many years ago.
Yeah.
I've heard of doctors coming in drunk and doing surgery or giving anesthesia if they're drunk or maybe they're on drugs. So which is better, folks? I mean, which would you rather have?
Yeah.
Give me a doctor who's on medication.
How about airplane pilots?
Yes. Yeah. Same thing, you know.
Same thing, right?
Yeah, the same thing. I mean, there's, you know, doctors who, you know, it's really a shame, and I don't know the answer, but things have got to change in the medical world, the mental health world, because the one thing was COVID, that COVID brought out, that I'm grateful for, was mental health, and that it was okay to go for help, because then you saw the celebrities, movie stars saying, hey, I'm depressed, I go for help.
Yeah.
But there was such a stigma to go for help, and it takes a strong person. If you think about it, folks, it takes a strong person to go for help, and they're being made fun of to go for help. And they still go because they want to overcome their struggles.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that does take a certain type of strength to do that. So that person's not weak at all. It's not a weakness at all. It was a strength for me to go for help, and I was being made fun of. By my family, I'm being made fun of. Not kids at school, my family. Call me all kinds of names. Because I called out the abuse, which you weren't allowed to talk about back then. You know, growing up in the 60s and 70s, we didn't talk about feelings. Nobody cared about our feelings. And there was a big stigma about mental health. And, excuse me, I'm so blessed to be able to use my voice to help other people, for the audience to know, whoever hears this around the world, that if you need help and you need support, no matter who you are, it's okay to do that. And it's okay to take medication if you need that. And people, don't judge. Do not judge anybody or criticize anyone that has to take medication or go for help, because you don't know, like I said, you don't know what life has in store for you, and you might find yourself needing to take something. It's a difficult world, I think, that we live in. We are getting dehumanized because people see things on TV. And I just think that we need to bring back our humanity for each other.
Yeah. Betsy, I don't remember if I sent you this. I wrote several scientific articles, and one was a few years ago on Espert. Do you recall me sending that to you? I don't know if I did or not. Espert stands for...
I think you did.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of is apropos for this discussion. So what happened was we collect a lot of data here. It's a large health facility. We take care of, we see about 120,000 patients a year. And so we collect a lot of data. And a few years ago, one of the data that that really stuck out was we were only diagnosing about 1% of the patients we saw as having either depression, substance abuse, or anxiety. So there's no way. So 1% out of that 100,000, that was it, you know. And I'm in the Youngstown, Ohio area. Well, it's not like, you know, it's a fairly economically depressed area. So that couldn't have been right, you know. So we ran several datas, and it was consistent. So one of the things I started doing was there's a concept called ESPERT, and it's an acronym standing for Screening, Brief Intervention, and Referral to Treatment, SBIRT. So what that is every patient that comes in, we give them a 6-question questionnaire. And it's basically highlighting, you know, how much do you drink? How much, you know, do you get nervous a lot? Are you depressed? And it goes into like 6 really simple yes and no questions. And if they answer yes to any one of them, it goes into a deeper set of questions, which kind of analyzes what's wrong with them. So after we started doing that, we took a test sample of about 6,000 patients, I think, at that time, and every one of those patients who had medical visit appointments all got these questionnaires, and it turns out that about 2/3 of those people answered in the affirmative or yes to these questions. You know, either they were depressed, they had a substance abuse, or they had anxiety problems. So 2/3, so 66, you know, 6% had one of those things. Whereas before, we were only diagnosing less than 1%. So the point is that doctors, I feel, have a responsibility to ask those questions, because we never do. Most people go to the doctors for physical ailments, but very rarely they come and say, hey, I'm depressed. But if we take the initiative and we ask them, they will say yes. And that was another article that I wrote, that it was beneficial for doctors to ask their patients, hey, are you depressed? You know, even if that's not what they came in for, you just say, hey, do you think you have any depression problems? Do you have any drinking problems and so forth? So the study was really, really good, and it was published in quite a few, you know, medical journals. And I think I sent it to you. If not, I can send it to you again. But it's very short. It's like 4 pages, but it's really eye opening, and it goes back to what you're basically preaching at this point is, hey, you know, talk about it, you know, get it out there.
Yeah.
And I think doctors have a responsibility to try to get it out of their patients. Why not? And if they would have asked my dad, if his doctor at that time would have asked him, I think he would have told him, because he wanted to tell somebody, I think. So anyway,
yeah.
just a you know, short blurb on that, but to say that, yes, you are correct, absolutely correct, and there's a lot of people walking around that have problems that don't say anything, that nobody knows about.
So yeah,
you're right.
That's true.
Yep.
That's
yep.
very true.
Yep. Yep.
Oh,
yep.
I love talking to you, Dr. Ryan.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say I'd give you a hug if I saw you right now.
Oh, thank you. yes, yes. I just love talking to you. You're doing a wonderful work. I want to mention for people to check out your books. I did read the award-winning book, 30 Days, Half September. Excellent. Dr. Ron was on back in September. And another award-winning book. I didn't get a chance to read it yet, but I'm sure it's wonderful. Don't Pick Up All the Dog Hairs. New book coming out. You'll let me know when. Come back on. Climbing Jacob's Ladder, which sounds phenomenal.
Yeah. Yes.
About a patient, a young boy you took care of who had cerebral palsy. That sounds interesting. Where can people connect with you, Dr. Ron?
Well, I have my own website. It's rondwinells.com. So it's rondwinells.com. And it's just a website. That's probably the easiest way. And then if they wanted to leave a note or something, they can.
And does your foundation have its own separate website, or can people go on your your website?
Yeah, it's there's a mention. Yeah, I had a separate website for it. It's under what do they call it, construction right now, refurbishment or something, whatever that's called. I'm not a big social media guy. I don't know that much about it, so I have my marketing people help me with that. So, it's under so-called construction at this point, so it's not available. But the rondwinells.com website has all the information there.
Oh, yes, and check out the Butterflies and Hall Memorial Foundation on Ron Dwinell's website. And the books, they're available on Amazon. I know that. Can they order it from your website, Ron, or just?
Yeah.
Well, they can.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yep.
Oh,
yep.
Great.
There's a link.
Great.
Yep.
I just love talking to you. I could talk to you all day about mental health issues. It's so important. So thank you so much, Dr. Ronald Dwinell, for coming on today. And God bless you for all you do for your patients, for humanity. You're just a lovely, wonderful soul. And we need more people like you to be out there and helping other people. And folks, all the information about Dr. Ronald Dwinell's will be on the in the blog. So make sure you read the blog that Jeannie White, who's the station manager, writes. And she produces the show. And I want to thank Lillian Caldwell, CEO of Patch World Talk Radio Network, makes this all possible. And I want to thank you, the listeners, for listening, subscribing, sharing. If you don't already subscribe, Chatting with Betsy is for free on Spotify, Spreaker, Amazon Music, Apple, to name a few. Please share the show to help other people. Maybe you know someone who's struggling. Maybe you know someone who lives in Ohio and you want to find out about the Butterflies and Hope Memorial Foundation. Maybe you know someone in Ohio that needs help, that needs support. If you need support in your local area, please refer to your primary care physician who can help you lead and guide you to support in your area. And if you are in crisis, call 988 if you are in the U.S. And that's what I have to say today, folks. As I always say at the end of my show, in a world where you could be anything, please be kind and shine your light bright, because we need it now more than ever before. And if you want to follow me, I'm on Facebook, Betsy E. Wurzel, W-U-R-Z-E-L. And that's it for today. Thank you for spending time with me. And thank you again, Dr. Ronald Dwinells, your busy man, for taking your time to chat with me today. Appreciate it. Appreciate you.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
Same here. This is Betsy Wurzel, your host of Chatting with Betsy on Passionate World Talk Radio Network. a subsidiary of Global Media Network, LLC. Chat with you later. Bye-bye.